Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. It's Sunday night, Mother's Day, on a nicer spring day than normal. I hope you are enjoying the nice weather, at least in the Midwest. Tonight we have our co-host, John Yoder, and I wanted to mention that the Duluth Reader got it right. They put our correct phone number in, which is 323-642-1691 if you want to call in. Tonight we're talking about Thomas Merton, Mother's Day, and other character defects that we can plan to remove in the future.
All right.
John, how was your Mother's Day? Did you do anything special in memory of your mother?
It was nice. At our church, they had a special service for the moms, and it is a different experience because my mom is, she's a ghost right now, and I love her, and it's one of those things where, you take all the things that they've given you in your life, your mom has passed on, and you live it out. You live it in memory, and it's a beautiful thing. Some people have bad relationships. I had with their parents. I had great relationship with my folks, and I have no regrets. If I needed to talk to them again, there's nothing that I need to bring up that we didn't go over. We were very secure in sharing with each other, and I didn't have unresolved issues. A lot of people they have unresolved stuff they never dealt with. But we kept the plate real clean, so it was really nice. It was just a great day. How about you, Jane?
I have good memories of my mother. I thought about her a lot during the week, not so much today. Mm-hmm. I'm thankful for Nancy and Joan for remembering me on Mother's Day. Nancy, my sister, and Joan, my sister. That was nice of them. They each sent me a gift card.
How cool.
And today's my older sister's birthday. She was born
really?
In 1955.
Wow.
Yeah, sometimes we had my grandma come down during that time of year, so we would all go out to eat on Mother's Day, and I have fond memories of that.
With my mom, she was a solid person. She was like a church lady, and it's funny. Growing up, we weren't allowed to go to the movies or Disney or anything. So the only way I could watch Walt Disney TV was Sunday night. They used to have it on at like 6 in the evening. Well, that was terrible because we'd go to Sunday night service, and there's no way in the world. Our church attendance was, a million straight services in county. We never missed a service. So it was like I could never watch Walt Disney unless around 4 o'clock, this mysterious cough I would start getting. And it was just like, I'd start acting sick. And I tried to, overheat myself in my bed and get sweaty. So my mom would say, are you having a fever? It's like, yeah, Mom, I feel terrible. And this is back in the day where parents could leave, I was, 7 or 8. You could leave a kid at home alone and you didn't have Child Protective Services arresting you. It was a different era.
How old
back
were
then.
You, like 8?
About 7 or 8. And but it's just a different time. We had everyone knew each other on the block. We were all. Oh, and
so did you watch the Disney show while your parents were at church?
Yeah, and then kind of after the show, mysteriously I would just be, I would recover. And but I tried to make it carry over for school, but that wasn't going to work with Mom. Because she would start doctoring me, giving me soup and this and that and, wrap this and put some Vicks VapoRub and all this, stuff. And, the only way to get out of that is, to get better. Otherwise, you'd have perpetual, medication torture. But the funny thing about it, it backfired once. We had this dog. The dog was in heat. And the parents said, whatever you do, don't let the dog out. Do not let the dog out.
Let the dogs out.
Well, wouldn't you know, and it was a small mixed little mutt, and wouldn't you know, I, don't ask me how could I do this, but I opened the door for a second and the dog ran out. And at the time, there was a German Shepherd just kind of going down the street, and they hooked up. Well, and I was like, oh, this is terrible. But then it went downhill from there. The German Shepherd decided to leave, but they were still hooked up. So the dog is walking down the street, dragging our other dog in tow. And all the neighbors are coming out there laughing. I'm 7 or 8. I'm like, oh, my goodness, you know, damage control. So I finally got the hose and sprayed them, and they disconnected. But water really does work if you throw it on a dog, if you can believe it. But
so your training days for Dog Diva started at a younger age.
It was right out of a cartoon, a really bad cartoon. You see my dog being dragged all fours, you know, trying to go back home with the other dog walking down the street. It was, yes, I was scarred, if you could say.
It sounds like that movie, you know, where there's bully dogs like the Fox and Hound or whatever. No, I think I'm thinking of a different one. Now, well, speaking of sin and deception and acting sick for your mom,
yes,
I'm going to read a couple paragraphs of Thomas Merton for my audience because that's what the meat and potatoes is tonight of the show.
Uh-huh.
I had covered it earlier with you. He was a monk who from Europe. His parents were artists, but he ended up becoming saved, and he went into the ministry, and he was a very insightful man. He wrote over a 400-page book called Seven Story Mountain. He writes, I had seen enough of the things, the acts and appetites that were to justify and bring down upon the world the tons of bombs that would someday begin to fall in millions. Did I know that my own sins were enough to have destroyed the whole of England and Germany? There has never yet been a bomb invented that is half so powerful as one mortal sin, and yet there is no positive power in sin, only negation, only annihilation, and perhaps that is why it is so destructive. It is a nothingness, and where it is, there is nothing left, a blank moral vacuum. It is only the infinite mercy and love of God that has prevented us from tearing ourselves to pieces and destroying His entire creation long ago. People seem to think that it is in some way a proof that no merciful God exists if we had so many wars. On the contrary, consider how in spite of centuries of sin and greed, lust, cruelty, hatred, avarice, oppression, and injustice, spawned and bred by the free wills of men, the human race can still recover each time and can still produce men and women who overcome evil with good, hatred with love, greed with charity, lust and cruelty with sanctity. In some ways, I think this generation failed. How could all this be possible without the merciful love of God pouring out His grace upon us? Can there be any doubt where wars come from and where peace comes from? Where the children of this world, excluding God from their peace conferences, only manage to bring about greater and greater wars the more they talk about peace. I'm almost done here. We have only to open our eyes and look about us to see what our sins are doing to the world and have done. But we cannot see. We are the ones to whom it is said by the prophet of God, hearing hear and understandeth not. See the vision and knoweth not. There is not a flower that opens, not a seed that falls into the ground, and not an ear of wheat that nods on the end of its stalk to the wind, that does not preach and proclaim the greatness and the mercy of God to the whole world. There is not an act of kindness or generosity, not an act of sacrifice done, or a word of peace and gentleness spoken, not a child's prayer uttered, that does not sing hymns to God before His throne in the eyes of men and before their faces. I am going to stop here, but I really think this person, Thomas Merton, was so profound that his very existence was almost regal or exalted. How would you feel about that, John?
Well, you know, it's interesting that it brought him up, and so I did just a little research, not a lot, but he was a Trappist monk, and I guess, although they didn't necessarily do the vow of silence, they believed in minimal talking, not wasting words, although he was a little bit wordy in comparison, but he liked their whole vow, which is like to basically speak when necessary. They believed in stability, fidelity to a monastic life, and obedience. And so they were very disciplined and very, they took their vows very seriously. And what's interesting is that with him, there was a certain point in his life where he was actually agnostic, or he did not believe in God and on a personal level, and where he did not believe in anything. And early in his life, and he had an experience going through Rome, going through the ruins and visiting churches, and he saw a picture or painting, mosaic of Christ, the Second Coming, and felt attracted to that and to pursue following and learning about it. So, I mean, that's pretty profound, because usually people are raised in a church and they kind of follow that path, but he actually sought it out.
I remember reading an earlier chapter about how he was agnostic. He had started out in some college in England where they partied a lot, and one of his friends died from drinking too much.
Wow.
But I can't remember what the inciting incident was that got him into salvation, but two of the Milwaukee 14 that, that group of men I told you about who burned draft cards, two of them were inspired by Thomas Merton to go into the ministry.
Wow.
So he did make a big impact on people around him.
You have to admire someone's dedication in anything when they're, and he seemed to be tolerant of other faiths. He connected with the Dalai Lama and different people, different Asian faiths. And because usually there's kind of a closed-mindedness to certain people in churches, in structured churches such as Roman Catholic Church and even Protestants, there's this disconnect, like, well, everyone else is going to hell, or like, we have the truth. But to be able to open the dialogue and communicate, like, to me, I think it's valuable. I don't see it as heresy or as being unfaithful. I think the path is following and examining the truth and being confident of the truth you have, not being insecure. And if I haven't examined other ideas, how do I know I have the truth? You know, it's like it's examining all things and realizing this is the best answer. I'm confident in my salvation and of Christ.
Well, I think some people are natural witnesses. Mm-hmm. And by him publishing this book, I mean, it really went to such a deeper level than any kind of Christian self-help book could. In fact, he even talks about how he was a communist for a while and how he had a belief in... He was. In fact, he wrote a chapter. He said, before I be... Here, I'll just read this short paragraph.
I knew there was a connection that would link him with you.
Well, actually, that's not... Okay, I just happened
just
to find this in Chapter 4.
Uh-huh.
But you have to realize back then, John, that the Russian Revolution was only 20-some years old. Communist was like a vogue thing even in New York City.
Right.
Where people would brag about being card-carrying. Even Dorothy Day, the Catholic social worker who started... the free lunch programs or whatever, she was a card-carrying communist. So it was kind of a vogue thing, and what its emphasis was is promoting a classless society. And actually, he writes in Chapter 4 about how capitalism became the basis of evil in the world.
Right, and to some degree, you know, being a level open-minded and a little level-headed, partly true. You know, I mean, if you think about our structure, our society, because with capitalism came a lot of free thinking, a lot of free ideas, and technology and the ability to, you know, mass produce and capitalize on the, you know, the money. And the point is, our culture, how many hundred more years can we go with the pollution and with the excess and, you know, the raping of our environment that we do? I'm not a big
even in China where there's no regulation.
Oh, yeah. And I'm not a big global warming kind of, you know, conspiracy person. I don't freak out on every little thing. But I can objectively sit back as an American, as a capitalist. I believe in the capitalistic system. But I can look back and say, I don't mind if we slow things down. And kind of like Devo, the band Devo, is like de-evolve. It's like progress at all costs is not good. You know, it's a growth. Uncontrolled growth is cancer. That's what, you know, it's just
okay, well, let me read this. See, he said he became a communist, but that was only a foreshadowing to Christianity. So he doesn't attribute it on any high level. He said, so now when the time came for me to take spiritual stock of myself, it was natural that I should do so by projecting my whole spiritual condition into the sphere of economic history and class struggle. In other words, the conclusion I came to was that it was not so much I myself that was to blame for my unhappiness, but the society in which I lived. I considered the person that I now was, the person that I had been at Cambridge, that's where he went to college, and that I had made of myself, and I saw clearly enough that I had the product. I was a product of my times. My society and my class, I was something that was spawned to selfishness and irresponsibility of a materialistic century in which I lived. Well, I'm not going to go on, but he's talking about a perspective that he was trying to, analyze the human condition, for lack of a better word.
Well, you know, and communism, in a way, is a basically kind of a takeoff spin on the first chapter of Acts, how the disciples and the apostles and the followers of Christ, they shared everything, they gave everything. You know, in a certain way, they were classless. I mean, God was their leader. But as far as having other levels of structure, I mean, you just kind of had your preacher, your teacher, evangelist kind of leaders. But, again, they were all considered equal, brothers and sisters sharing. They sold their possessions. They gave to the poor. They all kind of lived commune style. And so there's a lot of attributes on that that's actually very noble. The problem is with communism is they're saying that they're not acknowledging God. They're acknowledging state and man as being the high order and the, you know, the end in all, and it isn't. It's, you know, it may be a means to an end, but it's not an end in itself, and that's where you run into problems.
Well, I think he does acknowledge that partway through the book. He really only deals with the fact that he says we live in a society whose whole policy is to excite every nerve in the human body and keep it at its highest pitch of artificial tension, to strain every human desire to the limit, and to create as many new desires with synthetic passions as possible in order to cater to them with the products of our factories and printing presses. So he was mainly, you're right, he wasn't really acknowledging the carnal structure of communism as far as having a head, even if there's a central government, somebody has to run it, and man is sinful, and
right.
Man,
I mean,
has a sinful nature.
If we were raised in the Soviet Union or the Communist Bloc or Cuba, you know, however they pronounce it,
Cuba.
I mean, I could see us growing up going those decadent, you know, hedonistic, you know, pleasure-seeking Americans with all their cosmetic surgery, their polluting cars, and just they're ruining the world. And here in our simple, you know, common society, we found joy with our family structure, with helping each other, and you know, there's a lot of values in it that actually we could learn from. You know, I'm not a communist. I wouldn't.
Well, I think,
become,
you know, like every country has their own basis of patriotism, and mm-hmm. In high school we really don't. We learn about different governments, but actually, Mr. Bomker at San Fernando Middle School, he would put some He mentored me while I was teaching, but he would put up some Marxist quotes and ask the child to compare that to, like, a bourgeoisie capitalist quote. So he did challenge the kids, and I think it was called, it wasn't called mind-seeking activities. It was called something like critical thinking skills.
Right.
You know, where they would have to examine philosophical ideas.
The flip side, though, to it, of course, is that we're not all equal, and there, you know, some people are Kobe Bryant, some people are not good enough to be pro, some people are dumb, some people are fat, some people, you know, and it doesn't mean that's bad. It just means we're not all the same. Some people are rocket scientists. I'm not a rocket scientist. I'm not 7 feet tall. So when you get into a culture that says we're all equal and now equal opportunity, sure, but to say I am equal, I'm not. And so when you start getting that whole idea, well, okay, if everyone's equal in that system, who's in charge? Oh, well, the premier or the president or the Kremlin or whoever. Oh, and who enforces the law? Oh, well, you know, it used to be the KGB. Now they have a new form of police that's different than that. But the point is, someone's in charge. Oh, so we're not all equal, are we?
Well,
no,
I was just thinking the other day, you know, about pecking orders, like Rumor Willis, Bruce and Demi's daughter, was on Joan Rivers' show, The Fashion Police.
Right.
She's really, I don't think any of Demi's kids are that attractive except for Tallulah. She would have never made it in the movie industry had she not been the child of those two parents.
And I can't criticize people's looks because it's subjective, but I will say if I was a judge on a show or a talent agent for you have to subjectively say the majority of people would say those are not stunning looking children. No, I'm with you on that.
Right, and they kind of have Bruce Willis's bigger jawline, but they don't really have the femininity of Demi.
Right.
But she does have a good voice apparently, and she's premiering in a show. But still, it is like a. Even the Hollywood has their own set of network and inherited. Like every talented star's child doesn't make it. A few did, like Melanie Griffith was the daughter of Tippi Hedren, Angelina Jolie, the daughter of John Voight, but not every single celebrity child makes it to headlines.
No. Right. Or if
so
they do,
like
Martin Sheen's kids.
Emilio and Charlie Sheen, who ended up in drugs.
Right.
But there is a pedigree and a pecking order, but once they get into the open market, people still have to like them, no matter whose kid they are.
Right, right. Well, also, too, you know, some of them, they just didn't have moms like, you know, you and I had. I can tell you, like, my decadent story, my mom used to always pack tuna fish egg sandwiches every day and a banana, and I would take that to school. And, of course, being in a bus in a paper bag,
Would it smell?
Oh, you couldn't hide it, right? And there's always someone that's almost allergic practically to fish smell, and they're going to make a big stink about it, you know, like as if they're going to die. And it's always like, ooh, I can smell a tuna. It's Yoder, you know, and so you got the last name Yoder, and you got a tuna fish egg sandwich, and, you know, that was my only fear in going to school. It's like, oh, I got to carry it in this bag. And so I won a Bible contest at church, and I told this story once before, but the prize was to go to a San Francisco Giants baseball game. We lived in the Bay Area, and I was happy, not for the tickets, but because the Sunday school teacher, Dave Foster, imagine how he remembered this 50-some years later. Dave Foster was taking us in his cool car to the baseball game. I knew at the game he'd give us hot dogs and sodas, which we didn't have in our house, except, you know, 4th of July maybe. And so I was ready the day of the game. I'm all excited. And Mom says, before I walk out the door, oh, by the way, I packed your favorite. You know, here's your egg sandwich, egg tuna sandwich. I'm like in a paper bag, and I was like, oh, no, you know, help me, Jesus. It's like,
because you didn't want to bring it to the baseball game.
You can't hide it in a car, right? This is a 45-minute drive from San Jose to San Francisco. It's like,
you have just said thanks, but no thanks?
Oh, I smiled and said, thank you, Mom, because there was no, you know, I was raised to be obedient and humble and quiet and, you know, be seen and not heard. And it was like, I didn't know what to do. I didn't have the skills to negotiate. So I'm like, thank you. So I walked out the door, and the only thing I could think of in walking towards the car, seeing it outside, was throw it in the garbage can, you know, out the side of the garage. And so we went to the game, and sure enough, hot dogs, sodas, Giants won the game. I was all excited, the time of my life. Come back home, and Mom says, oh, how was the game? And I was like, oh, the game was just great. And she says, really? And, you know, did you enjoy your lunch and everything? Oh, yeah, it was great. It was great. Thank you, Mom. I said, I want to show you something. She grabbed my arm and marched me out of the house. I'm like, what's this all about? I really was surprised. And she started walking around the corner to the side of the garage. I'm like, no, it can't be. It cannot be. And she, there in front of me was the garbage can. She walked up to it, grabbed the lid, lifted it up, and said, behold, young man, your sins will find you out. And that they did. And
well,
I learned.
Maybe she shouldn't have packed that same smelly sandwich every day. Maybe she should get a lesson from it.
It did lead to the negotiation of having a metal lunchbox, which is, I got the Fireball XL5 from one of these, kind of like a Lost in Space kind of show. It was like one of those shows.
That's cute.
And it actually served a purpose because my best friend a year later, Jimmy Durick, got into a fight with a bully, the school bully, and I ran up to him.
You threw the tuna sandwich at him.
No, I hammered him with the metal lunchbox, and it knocked him over. We ran to my house across the street, and my mom was a stay-home, raise-the-kids mom, always at home 99.9% of the time, and the kid ran up to the front step, and I said, take one more step, before I'm going to open the door. My mom's going to come out, and she's going to give you a spanking, you know, and the guy ran off. I turn around, grabbed the doorknob, it was locked. Mom had gone to the doctor or something like that. But thank God the bully was gone. True story.
That's funny. We had Charlie Brown lunchboxes and Snoopy.
Really? See, you had cool lunch containers.
I work with a disabled client who saves everything from the 70s, and she still has a Snoopy lunchbox.
Any particular memories of your mom that stick out?
Yeah, we only have 2 minutes and 14 seconds left. She was just a very giving person, always interested in us, asking us how our day was. She would sit in the kitchen in her later years and read the newspaper cover to cover with her oxygen tank on.
Wow.
Ernest made a comment once. He laughed how she whipped that oxygen cord around because it was like 20 feet long.
Yeah.
It came from the dining room and it went all over the house.
Oh, wow.
So she would take walks at night through the kitchen to the living room, through the hallway, and then back through the dining room.
Mm-hmm.
And she made me exercise. She made me exercise with her sometimes after I moved in after my divorce, and I would follow her through the house with a plastic oxygen tube coming
wow.
from her nose.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of a depressing memory. But when she was younger, she was more lively, and she liked to sing and dance. And my brother had over 5,000 albums, and she would sing to the Beatles and dance.
Really? And I know you were short on time, but what put her into that condition? Did she have a stroke or something? Or?
No, she smoked 40 years, and her blood oxygen got low, and
uh-huh.
then she had to go on oxygen,
right.
but she did quit smoking cold turkey once that happened.
Wow.
In fact, she
crazy.
Was in L.A. At the Pasadena Huntington Library when we discovered how she couldn't breathe very well, and she had
right.
to stop and catch her breath. And she was like 61 or 62 then, and that's when we noticed that she was in trouble.
Oh, wow.
How about your mom? What's your best memory of your mother?
You know, I just had so many
or
cool things.
Or a series of memories.
Yeah, one of the things that she always did was like birthday cakes. She was a great cook, and she would make the coolest birthday theme cakes. You know, it'd be like she'd make it like a Batman, Batmobile, or castle, or whatever the theme. Baseball. You should put like these baseball players on the cake, and with a big, you know, bat and a ball kind of thing. Just really creative mind. She made puppets, and she used to teach. Like we'd have like a vacation Bible school or special events at church. One year, they did a fundraiser in a small country church. They did it looked like a rocket ship. And as the attendance would go up, it was like a church of 50. If they got to 100, 120, that was the goal. And they actually set it 1 month. And what they did is they got a big bowl, like a bucket with dry ice. And they ran some sound through the PA to make it sound like the spaceship was taking off. And people, the old-timers, were literally hanging on to their seats. They thought it was going to take off. So she was very creative in that way. But she always, above all, she always said, you know, whatever you do, I've dedicated you to the Lord. And that's your whole, no matter what you do, as long as you're living for Jesus and living for God, I'm good. And that's what I take with me, and I appreciate that value that she gave me. And a lot of people don't have that, but you know, at the end of the day,
my
mom
was pretty adamant too about, I don't want to call it religion, mm-hmm. but having Christ as the center of our lives.
Yes, it's something that at the end of the day, when the chips are down, no matter what, you can go, you know what, Mom, I'm going to stay true to, you know, to that dedication you gave to my life, and I'm going to honor that and respect it. And it's, if you don't have that in your life, it's very easy to get lost out there and get in the middle of the sea and you don't know where to turn. But you always have that
That's
guiding
true.
Light.
And I remember being in Sunday school and memorizing Psalms 23 at age 4.
Yes.
I was in church my whole life. I was in choirs. I was in confirmation, which is something the Catholics and the Lutherans do, where you memorize the catechism.
Mm-hmm.
And I did have a strong foundation in my beliefs, even though I strayed oftentimes in older years. My parents gave us a good foundation.
Right.
So with that, we have to end the show, unfortunately, but thank you for joining us. I think it was probably our best episode since we've gone solo without the eye in the sky.
The eye in the sky.
So... with the ending of the show, we'll say, Happy Mother's Day, Ernest. His mother died less than 2 years ago from colon cancer. She was only 65.
Wow. Well, we do wish Ernest well. And
How old was your mother, by the way?
79, and I actually was expecting her to live to be in the 90s. That's kind of the family line on her side. And but you know, after my dad passed away early at 66, she really didn't have the will to fight. She lived life, but she wasn't fighting hard. And you have to, I think, at a certain age. So, and that's okay. She knew where she wanted to be. She always said, "We're just visiting this planet, and this world is not our home." And those are words, good words to live by.
There's a Christian artist that has a song called "Visiting This Planet." With that, we'll end the show. Thanks for joining me, and I'll see you Wednesday night. Good night, everyone.
Good night, and God bless.
Say your famous line.
Follow the truth wherever it leads you, even if it's to a baseball game with a metal lunch pail.
Mine is follow the truth wherever it leads you, even... though it accidentally takes you to a casino.
Double down on that one.
My lunchbox is better than yours. Just kidding. Okay. keep in mind the words and wisdom of Thomas Merton, how one sin can lead to destruction.
Nice.
I can vouch for that. Okay. Good night, everyone. Good night.
Good night, James.